A recurring theme of this podcast, when it originally ran back in 2020, was that in the 1990s, Apple was really weird. And in hindsight, yes, Apple was on a trajectory that would lead it toward bankruptcy. This is when I started writing about Apple for a living. A few months before I started my internship at Mac User Magazine, so it would have been late 1992, Apple introduced a new lineup of Macs. This was a very 90s Apple thing to do. 90s Apple was full of product lines of various kinds. If you remember Steve Jobs coming back to Apple and introducing that four-product grid, that was a direct reaction to the incredible complexity of Mac models created in the 1990s by Apple. The thing about this new product line from 1992 is that it wasn't really even a product line. It was all about marketing. Apple decided that it would take mostly existing Mac systems, tweak their specs and software, add some bundled programs, and sell them directly to consumers. Instead of shopping for a computer at some scary computer store, you could buy these new Macs in familiar surroundings, just a stone's throw from those Kenmore appliances and those KitchenAid mixers at your local Sears. You could buy a Mac. And this was a Mac made just for you, the curious home computer consumer. It came with an inspiring name that told you how well it would perform. It was the Macintosh Performa. Those of us who remember it probably wish we didn't. Those of us who don't, well, that's why this podcast is back. I'm Jason Snell. It's 20 Macs for August 2024. This is Performa Month. I'm joined now by the inventor of Performa Month, Mr. Stephen Hackett. Stephen, welcome back. You were actually here with me on the most recent episode of 20 Macs, and now we're back to celebrate Performa Month. Again, I just want to be clear, a thing you invented. Hello.
When the universe gives you the opportunity to invent a holiday, I think you have to take it.
Why? First question, just tell it, why? Why Performa Month? What? I mean, more. I'm not trying to be too aggressive here. What was the genesis of your idea of, I think people in the year 2024 need to hear about what Apple did in the 90s when it was weird?
Really, you're questioning most of the existence of 512 pixels, which I find upsetting. I and you and this show, like, we've covered a lot of ground over the years in terms of interesting Macs and, to a lesser extent, iPods and iPhones and iPads and stuff. But I kind of felt like there was this sort of big gaping hole in my coverage, and it was the Performa line. I know, I thought it would be interesting to dive into what is really the messiest part of the Mac's history. And it lived up to that promise, I think. This was actually very difficult at times to kind of pull things apart. But I wanted to take my best effort at explaining why the mid-90s in the Mac history, like why that era was so troublesome and what was going on there.
As I said in my intro, this is the origin story in some ways of the Steve Jobs four product grid.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's very much a reaction to the we've talked about it being a reaction to the complexity of the Mac product line at the time, right? But like the Performas were the biggest kind of like littering of the namespace, confusing of what,
yeah,
like I don't even think about them. And this is one of the reasons why I questioned you going down this path. I think it's good to talk about it, but is it working for the latter part of the Performa era at Mac User? I can tell you, we just ignored them for the most part, because for the most part, they were just other computers rebadged, rebundled, and made to go to particular places. So when you're thinking of it, you're like, well, PowerMac 6100 is a computer.
Yeah.
And then you're like, aha, but what about the Performa 6110, 6112, 6115, 6116, 6117, and 6118, all of which were just the same computer with slightly different specs or software bundles.
Yeah, the namespace pollution really was a side effect of the badge engineering that was going on, which you often see in the automotive world, right? There'll be a GMC pickup and a Chevy pickup, they're the same truck, right? They're just different names, maybe slightly different details. And Apple was doing this in the 90s. They would take an LC or a Quadra or later a Power Macintosh, you know, once we were past the 68K Power PC transition. And they would decontent it sometimes, right? They'd take a floating point unit out or slow it down somehow. They'd add a lot of bundled software to it. And then they would stick it in department stores with the hope that parents or a teacher or somebody would come in and, gosh, this computer, it's got everything I need. It's, you know, it's got a display with it, or it's got all the accessories, has all the software that, you know, my kid can learn geography with. And to a degree, they did definitely sell them into homes and to some schools, but it definitely came with a high price of consumer confusion and brand, just kind of a very messy branding problem.
It's a weird one because, especially in this era, this was the CD-ROM era. This is where I entered writing about Apple, was the CD-ROM era, where I was like, oh my God, you could get so much on a CD-ROM. And so now you had computers as sort of like reference material. You could put a whole encyclopedia on there. There's so many things you could do with CD-ROMs. And the feeling was, this is now almost like a new kind of home. It's like a new home entertainment format. And so I think they felt like there's a real opportunity here to reach consumers with these products. And I get it. Like, for people who don't know, like, if you could only buy a computer in a computer store, the computer stores were really, they could be very intimidating. That, you know, and you may be less comfortable going in there at all. Whereas if you're at Montgomery Ward or Sears or something, it's just right there. And they were trying to reach people who might be interested in it if they could lower the barrier to entry. I get all of that. I guess the challenge with thinking of them as you know, Performa 6116 CD now is they were really kind of like hacking the retail chain by doing this. Like, there is nothing stopping them from selling a PowerMac 6100 with some bundled software at Sears. But instead of doing that, they gave them all unique numbers. And I know one of the knocks on the Performa line, one of the classic knocks on the Performa line, is that sometimes you'd have a computer that was identical to another number.
Mm-hmm.
And the only difference was where it was sold, or maybe the bundle. But a lot of times it wasn't even the bundle. It was literally, you know, 17 means Sears and 18 means Montgomery Ward, something like that.
It's almost as if like the internal product tracking became the product names.
Yes. And I think personally that this is one of the things that Steve Jobs, I'm not sure if we ever have any Steve Jobs on the record commentary about the Performa, but I would bet you that one of the reasons Apple's corporate culture to this day is keep the base name of the system as plain as possible is because of a reaction to that. The idea of like, yeah, you can have like a SKU or a generation or whatever. We're just going to call it the latest MacBook Air. And like, I know they increment the iPhone, but you know, I feel like Jobs, when he came back, was really into minimal. I mean, he was always into minimalism, but like really into the minimalism of the product line. And the Performa, like they didn't care. I'm not sure anybody got value out of having a 6115 CD instead of a 6100.
No.
But they decided to make the identity of the computer encapsulate their marketing strategy. It's very weird. It's just a very weird. I'm sure there were some real expediency reasons for them to do it, but it got really confusing because people would be like, I have a Performa. And you're like, well, which one? I was like, well, 6114. And you're like, okay, well, that's a 6100 Power Mac is what that is. And, you know, that's all that matters at that point. But instead of it being, I have a solution for one computer, it's like, I have a solution for all these computers with this number.
Yeah.
Because they were all the same.
I think the other thing that's just so different from how Apple and really the rest of the industry works today is Macs are named and branded basically by their form factor. So like the Mac Mini is the Mac Mini, right? It changes over time a little bit, but it, you know what it is, a small desktop Mac. The iMac is an all-in-one. Sure, it started with a CRT and now it's, you know, razor thin, but it's an all-in-one. And that just wasn't true in the 80s, but definitely in the 90s, right? There were LCs that were small desktops and there were LCs that were all-in-ones. There's something like, I don't know off the top of my head, maybe 6 or 7 different form factors that performers could come in, different desktop style cases, a couple of different all-in-ones. At the very end, it came in a tower form factor. Like the idea now that a computer's identity is what it looks like just really wasn't the case back then. And that really was something that when I was getting into this in the planning and the writing of it, it's like, oh, this is like fundamentally different from how we think about what computers are today.
And it's not just about the performer. I mean, this was one of the challenges. If you think about all of Apple's product line, it was kind of like that. It was very much a kind of a spec-based lineup or marketing-based lineup in a lot of ways. So like Quadra originally was just a 68040 processor. That's a Quadra. But you could have Quadras and Centrises, you know, and then when they went to Power Mac, it was just Power Mac, which is great. But like there were Mini Tower Power Macs and Pizza Box Power Macs. They took all sorts of different shapes and sizes because what was defining them was they had a PowerPC chip in them and they were a desktop, or it was a mid-range model, or it had a certain chip in it. It wasn't, again, I think that simplification that happened with Steve Jobs motivated on this era, which was let's try to say this is this shape of computer and it has this name, and instead of it being all kind of a marketing process, which is, I mean, it's a weird way that the Mac evolved from its beginnings, where they, you know, originally they had like the classic line all pretty much look the same. But LC was like low cost, and that it could mean anything, but, you know, it basically meant kind of pizza box-ish kind of things. And they just kept getting more and more complicated over time.
Yeah, and the Performa line, I mean, it really did last until Jobs came back. The final machines kind of went away in 97, and that's sort of as when the Grid of Four is taking place. We think of the Grid of Four as the iMac in 1998, but they were working towards that in those earlier days as well. I think the other thing I want to touch on here is that software story, right? That these things were bundled with just tons and tons of software. And you mentioned it being like the CD-ROM era, right? And that was, yeah. I grew up in that era, right? That was like, yeah, like, oh my gosh, you can have 650 megabytes of data. Like, it's bananas. Even early on in the Performa line, they knew CD was going to be important. If you look through my posts, CD is in the name of most of the machines because you could get some without them. But I think it was more about advertising, like, yes, we are in this era, we are here. And the software that was bundled was really geared towards those customers Apple wanted, right? They wanted a family to buy this for their family computer, right? There are a couple of big notable exceptions to that in the Money Magazine computers where Apple partnered with Money Magazine. And those Macs came with things like software to create your will, or like to balance your checkbook. Like,
yeah,
weird story, but that's something else we just don't see today. We just don't see, at least on the Mac, we don't see bloatware like this.
So what they were doing is, I think they were taking an appliance kind of view of it, which is why, you know, when you think about going to Sears and having, you know, your washing machine over here and your stand mixer over here, your dishwasher over there, that they were trying to say, like, I think a good impulse, which is, what is this computer for? Like, let's get a computer. Those people had already maybe gotten a computer, but how do I convince somebody that they can actually use this computer? And so, yeah, in a lot of those retail stores, they were sort of saying, look, this is going to be great. It's going to be great for your kids. Not only the general drift of you should get a computer for your kids because computers are obviously the future. Even when I was growing up, that was very much people were like, oh, these computers, you got to get one because your kids got to do it because this is the future. They weren't wrong. And then you throw in, like, when you buy this thing, you get an encyclopedia that just comes with it. And, you know, whatever, print shop or what, you know, other things, you kind of throw them in there and you're trying to make that sale. And Money Magazine, as weird as that was, they were trying to reach an audience and say, this is a computer you can buy, and it comes with this stuff that makes it a solution to your problem. And if you think about it, a less sophisticated user, especially in the 1990s, isn't necessarily going to think, okay, here's my plan. I'm going to buy a computer. It's going to be very expensive and essentially not do anything. because it doesn't have any software other than what comes with it. And then I will go and find software that does what I want, and I'll buy that, and they'll send it to me, and I'll install it, and then I'll run. Like, it's so many steps to go, and Apple's like, no, Money Magazine. You're, you know, Quicken or whatever, and Willmaker, it's, you get it with it. And like, on one level, yeah, that's how computers should be. Now we have an app store pre-installed on all our devices. You can just go get whatever software you want. But like, in those days, there was a real problem of like, you get the computer and then now what do you do? Does it do anything? And so they were trying to solve that problem.
So as you mentioned, you were starting your career covering Apple in these days and basically ignored the performance. What surprised me, and this is what I'm curious, if you guys had this feedback in the day or if it's something that people kind of view in hindsight, I've been totally blown away by how much feedback this project generated. And almost all of it has been, hey, my first Mac was a 630 CD that my parents brought home and I loved it. Like, it was a lot of people's first experience with the Mac. And I find it kind of hard to reconcile that with what I know now, like in hindsight, like, yeah, a lot of this computer line was really messy and kind of a bad idea. Did you have the sense at the time that these were impacting people?
Well, I think, you know, from when I say we kind of ignored it, the fact is that it added a level of complexity and we were trying to reach a probably more professional audience. And, you know, if you read about the PowerMac 6100, that's all you need to do. And yes, okay, there are also performers that are essentially the PowerMac 6100. But if you're viewing it, I mean, like, the way that I would cover Apple today, I would look back then, if I did that, and I would say, this is an interesting exercise to try and reach, like I was saying, people in places that computers don't go. And if you're thinking about the computer for the rest of us and all of that, and you're thinking about the fact that Windows and DOS and PCs are basically, they own the corporate market outside of like design, but you are strong in education, then one of the places that you could crack is the home, because the home doesn't have an IT manager with eight other Windows PCs or DOS PCs in that era. So you could crack that and you could say, hey, you know, comes with CD-ROM. It's got some encyclopedia. There's a bunch of, you can buy Myst if you want to and play a game, but it comes with this encyclopedia. You get a printer and you got print shop and you can print stuff out and your kid can do their report in ClarisWorks or whatever. And you could make a sale there. And I think that was really smart on Apple's part. I can quibble with the idea, like, I would ask the question, why didn't you just sell a bundle with a PowerMac 6100? And I think the answer is going to be, there were reasons, right? I'm sure there were reasons. I'm sure that either the stores wanted particular SKUs or the way that Apple's distribution network worked, they needed to create this different alternate means of distribution. For whatever reason, it made it messy, especially if you're the press. But like, I think as a business decision, it was really smart because there were not a lot of places for the Mac to go in that era. And they were leveraging the CD-ROM, the rise of the CD-ROM as a way to sell computers with more data in them. I mean, again, before the CD-ROM, just because nobody was online in this era, just to be clear, before the CD-ROM, you couldn't do something like, say, it comes with the World Book Encyclopedia or the Grolier Encyclopedia. But you could fit that encyclopedia on a CD-ROM. And, you know, it would be a program and you double click it and opens it all, but all the data is on that 650 megabyte CD. You couldn't do that before. It would have come in like 15 disks or whatever that you would have had to install on your little tiny hard drive, and it would have filled the hard drive, and like, CD-ROM was way better. And so they had their moment where they said, okay, we give people a reason to buy a computer. We'll price these aggressively, probably by manipulating the specs, right? Like, to have it be cheaper so that they can get them in and fit them in at a nice price. And then obviously you had that picture of that Sears store. They work with Sears. So like, literally you have a picture of people trying out a Performa 400 at Sears, and it's sitting on a little kiosk with like a little card explaining, extolling the virtues. And in the background are washers and dryers. Right?
Yeah.
So that's what they're trying to do, is they had a plan. I think it's a smart plan. And I think you're right. Hearing from people saying this was my first Mac shows you that it worked to a certain extent. Like, as much as it could have worked, they did identify a place where they could make sales. It obviously worked because those people exist. Was it more expensive than what it was worth? Did it move sales around? Did it affect the Mac in other ways? These are questions that I don't know. We would have to go back in time and ask the people who were there. It clearly had a legacy. Like I said, I think the two legacies are Steve Jobs and the four product grid and the people who bought these, because they did reach buyers. I'm sure there were a lot of parents who knew about computers but were completely intimidated and thought about it for their kids. And then they went to Sears and there it was, or you know, wherever else, something like that, Circuit City, Silo, to buy a, I bought a stereo at Silo when I was in college, to buy a stereo or something. And you see the computer and like, oh, hmm. And it's like, oh, and it comes with these things. And like, and they lowered those barriers and they made a sale in an era where the internet, so the internet was just around the corner. And that was the thing we talked about it when we talked about the iMac and the 20 Mac series. The internet and getting online and searching the web and all those things, that replaced the CD-ROM as the motivating factor. And it was a stronger motivator because it was infinite, essentially, information potentially that you could do. But this that was just off in the distance. It was not really practical in this era. And so instead, it was like, how do we sell people on these computers? And obviously it did that. 90s Apple was troubled in a lot of ways. I feel like the approach they took here is super weird. Like you said, it's labeling differentiation is all that's really going on here. But it definitely, I get the motivation, and I think that there's a lot of wisdom to it, even if in the end it was really messy. And again, I want to say there must have been a better way, but I'm also kind of like accepting that this way is so convoluted that there probably wasn't a better way. And this was like their best shot at getting into those stores was by doing these special labeled computers and putting them in there.
Having all the model names be different, I'm sure the retailers liked that, right? Like, oh, this is the Mac that we sell, you know?
And you can't compare it.
And you can't,
Nobody know. You don't know enough to compare it. You can't say, oh, well, this is the same as that and it costs this, and so therefore I'm getting a good or bad deal. It's like, no, only Sears is selling this one. I don't know. One of the things, by the way, that I really enjoy about the performance stories that you've done on 512 Pixels is you and I have access to a text archive of Mac Week, which was the definitive, I would say, you know, basically weekly newspaper about Apple in this era. And it's not on the internet. And so it's really been a joy to see you cite those Mac Week stories in your pieces, because those stories don't, I mean, you some of it is scanned in somewhere, but like really hard to find that kind of stuff. And it's one of the challenges with writing about this era is how do you get they've scanned in Macworld and Macworld and Mac User are scanned in for the most part, but again, didn't cover them as much. But Mac Week did. And so I love that you quote all these names that I recognize from Mac Week from back in the day. So that's been a fun part of the project, is being able to use that Mac Week archive. I wanted to shout out the old Mac Week folks, because they did some great work that's been largely made invisible to modern eyes.
Yeah, and finding firsthand reporting from this era is hard, because most of it was before the internet. You know, if you're talking about the iBook G4, you know, I can go pull your Macworld review. Now it's still online, right? And go get it. It's harder when you're dealing with things in the 90s.
Yeah.
The hardest thing actually in all of this was pricing for a few reasons. One, firsthand reporting, which is hard to come by. And even what is out there very often wouldn't include pricing, because it's like tech reporting, right? So they would just talk about like how this one's different from that one. And the pricing changed all the time, because Apple would discount these, their partners would discount these over time.
It's another reason why they probably had their own numbers, is so that they could kind of float freely based on however it was going at whatever the partner was and whatever sale they wanted. And they probably had that ability.
All in all, I'm glad that we could all celebrate this. And now it's finished.
Now this is like your little validatory speech. So what was the thing that surprised you the most in doing this project? What did you learn that was the most surprising?
I don't think I realized going into it the amount of sharing that the performance had with other Macs. Like, I knew that like, most of them were just like, it's a Power Mac or a Quadro with a different label. But when you get into it, They also share a lot of the architecture stuff, as you may imagine. But some of them are like remixes, like, oh, it's an LC inside, but it's in a Quadra case, except the case has this and not that. Like, I assume almost all of that was done in terms of price, right? Like, how can we make these things as cheap as possible? And sometimes that meant Apple cut corners technologically, right? Like, oh, this is, on paper, it's equivalent to this Power Mac, but they used a board that didn't support memory that was as fast, or a bunch of the early ones didn't have floating point units. It was a separate chip, and it basically very few performers had that. And so, yeah, on paper, it's, you know, the same 60 megahertz as in this other computer, but in reality, it's 30% slower. And like, all of the detail of that was interesting to get into. And it's, I think some people think about the performance like Apple just slapped new stickers on Macs and shipped them out the door. And sometimes they did, but other times they did go in there and actually make them worse to make them either not compete with the higher end Macs or to make them cheap enough to stick in, you know, your big box retailer.
To hit a price point, I think that that's, yeah, replacing the 68040 with a 68LC040, which was basically no FPU. And so it was a cheaper chip. They put a cheaper chip in it that was slower, and that led them to sell it cheaper. And they did a lot of that kind of thing. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I am most impressed by the fact that people have come to you and said, ah, yes, that was my first computer too, because I feel like that is the ultimate validation of this strategy. And so it's fun to hear about that because, you know, they did the LC, which was trying to make a cheaper Mac. And I know a lot of people whose first Mac was an LC, but hearing about the Performa, like, again, what is Performa as a brand? It actually doesn't mean anything. What, you know, it doesn't represent, as you said, any kind of computer. It was really more about a computer with a bundle that was sold in a more, you know, I guess less conventional for the time place to sell a home computer. And so anybody who says, I grew up, you know, my first computer was a Performa, that's a win for 90s Apple, because they reached people. I think every one of those people is somebody who they obviously hadn't reached and maybe wouldn't have reached otherwise. And so that's a win and a validation and perhaps reason enough for Performa Month to exist. Perhaps.